5. Containing, well, or enmeshed in, if you like, so many undercurrents. I'm going to stretch the metaphor a bit thin here. So without further ado, I'll say a very good evening to our special studio guest, Peter Sawyer, among other things, the editor of Dole Bludging, a taxpayer's guide, and a former Social Security investigator, now editor of a newsletter, which isn't on the newsstands. You have to write away for that, and that's called Inside News. And no doubt your biography will contain many more pages than that, Peter.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Welcome aboard, anyway.
Good evening.
Now, you've been involved in a bit of a battle with the establishment, to put it mildly, for a few years since you felt you were banging your head against a brick wall when they wouldn't accept your suggestions on ways to streamline the system, particularly in Social Security. You saw loopholes. You felt if you observed them, then people would close them. And am I right in saying you realized after a while that they didn't want some of these loopholes closed, that they had some long-term reason?
Well, back then, Brian, they, according to them, there weren't any loopholes. I mean, Brian Howe, the minister, was quoted as saying that my claims were sheer fantasy, hysterical nonsense. Welfare fraud was running at less than $20 million a year. That was back in December 85. That was before Bob Hawke needed $350 million to finance election promises. But, yes, it's my feeling now that they never ever meant to clean it up. It's serving the purpose it's meant to serve.
You mean making people go, tut, tut, we need an ID system because there are too many people cheating the system?
That's correct, yeah. There's nothing in the welfare system that couldn't be cleaned up by Christmas, so I can only assume they're letting it run until they get their national surveillance system, not identity system, national surveillance system up and running. Mm-hmm. Then they'll clean up welfare fraud and say, look how effective it all was.
Well, I guess we call it an identity system because in order to make sure that they've got one number for everybody and they've got your photograph and whatever, they have to identify you so they know who they're conducting surveillance on.
No, Brian. The entire ID card and ID legislation and everything that's been going on, it was entirely a red herring to keep us off the track of what's really been going on. The work, the true work, is now virtually completed. The post office has come online onto a system in January and it will be completed. The ID card, the legislation and everything really have nothing to do with it. There's no need to give people a number. They're already numbered on the computer. There's no need to get them to carry their number around. They know who you are. We were led to oppose the ID card. We were led to believe that it was defeated. We've all thrown our arms up in the air and said, we won, we won, we won. And the real problem, the database that's got everything on us, including what we had for breakfast, is up and running in Canberra.
Why did they bother with the legislation? 130 pages or something like that? Why? That's a long-winded way of distracting us.
It's not really, Brian.
Or would it have cleaned up a few loose ends for them? I mean, obviously, setting up the new system for passports was a forerunner to the photographs and the interviews for the ID card, wasn't it?
I'll make no mistake about it. By March next year, we will have the ID card and the ID legislation. In fact, the forms have been printed down in Albury-Wodonga. That asked some incredible questions, but this current exercise was merely to take our mind off what we, what the real work was, and to judge just exactly how and where opposition to the card would come from, so that they know what to do next time round. The real run, as you know from your own observations, they usually do things twice. This was the practice run. The real one comes in March next year.
I must admit, I hadn't noticed that they did things twice. They usually get their own way, or they get beaten and go and try something else.
They always,
whoever
do,
they are,
always do things twice, and invariably they appear to lose the first time round, Brian.
So you drop your guard.
So yeah. You drop your guard. Yep.
I can understand the logic of it, but when you were in the department, you noticed there was a lot of computing equipment that was being purchased not being used. Is that right?
There was, up until the end of last financial year, there'd been $185.5 million worth of computing equipment bought for something called StratPlan, which was Social Security's answer to welfare fraud and that, non-existent welfare fraud, according to the minister. And the simple, blunt sort of truth is that StratPlan doesn't exist. So I thought all these computers were sitting in a warehouse going obsolete, but I've more recently learnt that they are in a building in Canberra doing exactly what they were originally bought for, and that is to establish a database on us all.
Hmm. And how many people know about this? There's an old saying that you can't fool all the people all the time. And you're suggesting that they have fooled all except one for almost all the time during the ID card debate.
Oh, they haven't fooled everybody, Brian. I mean, I've brought you in photographs tonight of the building,
mm-hmm.
which were taken by other people who weren't fooled. The public servants who work down there know exactly what they're involved in. Whether or not they'll ever stand trial for treason, I don't know. Obviously, some government ministers and previous government ministers know about it. This building was only ever built as a telephone exchange. It's the only telephone exchange in Australia with armed guards. And
you've seen them? Armed guards?
I haven't seen them, no. I've had some people go down there and try and get into the building, and I'll be going down there myself next week and attempting to get into the building. But it's actually referred to, even though it's a telephone exchange, it's referred to in the directories of other government departments in Canberra as the National Computing Centre. And I don't think too many Australians are even aware we've got a National Computing Centre. And I think they're even less aware that in the last 5 years we've spent $1.5 billion on the National Computing Centre, which makes it more expensive than our federal parliament house.
How do you come by that figure?
Well, I'd tracked down what Social Security had spent there, Brian, and then it was only last week that I learnt that this building in Kent Street in Deakin actually had other government departments in it, apart from Social Security. So once I learnt which of the other government departments were in there, it was relatively easy to do the same thing that I did with Social Security, and that was tracked back through all the computer hardware that's been bought that hasn't showed up anywhere else.
Mm.
And now I know where it is.
If someone spends $100 on the hardware, how much are they likely to spend on the software?
Probably an equivalent amount.
50-50. So that's, when you say $1.5 billion, that's just on the hardware.
That's just on the hardware. That's not the cost of the building with the 4-foot thick concrete walls. It's not the cost of the desks and the office furniture and the carpets and everything. That's the cost of the computer hardware.
Why would they build a building with 4-foot walls when, for security, it would probably be more cost effective to go underground and have walls infinitely thick?
I've got no idea, Brian. Considering that the building officially doesn't exist, except as a telephone exchange, and interestingly, it's administered by the Department of Local Government and Administration, but their official figures for the building, all the area that's leased out, all the corridors, cafeterias, toilets and everything, adds up to 13,234 square metres. But the actual building has 33,000 square metres of office space, of space. So, so over half the building, even the people who administer the building, aren't aware that it exists, so they can't be aware of what goes on in it.
Is this a bit like the old story about the baby carriage factory in Nazi Germany? And a fellow working there wanted to take home one of the baby carriages because his wife was expecting them. They said, no, you're not allowed to do that. All this production is destined for a particular place. And so he started taking pieces home. He thought he'd build his own baby carriage and stole piece by piece what he thought was a baby carriage. When he got home, he built a perfectly good machine gun. They hadn't been telling the workers what they were making because each one was working on only one part of the design. Is this the same sort of logic?
Only as far as it's presented to the people, Brian. The people who work in the building know full well what they're working on. When they come out, attempts have been made to talk to the staff in there, and they merely answer that they're sworn to secrecy. So not only is it the only telephone exchange with armed guards, it's the only one where the staff are sworn to secrecy.
The only one? Well, surely you'd have defence.
Yeah, they're not telephone exchanges, but...
Now, this is in Kent Street, Deakin.
Yes, it's known as the Deakin Centre.
And like most Canberra buildings, it's concrete, and it's rather sinister, and very, very drab, and... Well, rather unusual. If it has windows, they're just narrow slots.
Yeah, only the ground floor has windows. The upper two stories have no windows whatsoever.
Very grim-looking place. There's nothing flash. There's a flag outside, a car park. And you were first alerted to this by what?
Well, I traced the computing gear for Social Security back to this building, and I thought that was all that was in there. Over this last week, we've found out... you know, they keep telling us with this ID system that certain departments would never be linked up. Well, it turns out that all sharing the same computing facilities in there is Social Security, Taxation, Defence, Immigration, Bureau of Statistics, Health, several smaller departments. Telecom have a small space in the building which is used for overseas satellite telecommunications. One wonders why our social security and taxation affairs have to be interlinked to satellite telecommunications to overseas. And there is a separate little area known, it officially hasn't got a name yet, but it's known as State Computing Services at the moment. The State Computing Services is that area that is going to magnanimously offer to put the births, deaths and marriages that we've already been told about, and what we haven't been told about yet are vehicle registrations, gun licenses and driver's licenses. And that, Brian, is why they don't need the ID card with the photo on, because while we were all arguing about the ID card, the legislation's gone through here in New South Wales and is proceeding in other states for driver's licenses with photographs on, which is how they will get your photo into that computing system.
If you've got a driving license. What about all the people that don't have one?
Well, if we get it in for all the people with driving licenses and we follow it up with a card, which is a system which has already been mooted for people on welfare benefits.
Mm-hmm. Your welfare card, or you'll have a social security number like the
state. That's right. By the time we've got everybody with driver's license and everybody with is on some form of welfare, then there aren't that many people left over anyway, Brian.
Mm. In the early days of the card, it was considered, I suppose, unnecessary to have one number linking all the databases, because computers can crunch numbers without any trouble, and if you had separate numbers for your license and your social security number and your number on your birth certificate or whatever, would that really bother a computer? Once the computer's told that those three numbers are linked, it becomes one big number, doesn't it?
It's a fallacy, Brian, that they have to give you a single number. I mean, you could just go up to a master key in Brian Wilshire. The computer will list all the Brian Wilshires. You probably with a date of birth. You pick out the one that's got the right date of birth. You call up the menu on him and it will list all his social security number, tax file number, bank account numbers and so on. You don't, this idea that you need a number somehow to tie these things together.
The people with the false bank accounts, the people with the multiple names, wouldn't they need some sort of ID system with photographs to try and crack down on that, saying you can't take your money out of the bank until you prove you're the person that the computer knows you are?
Brian, all these kind of scenarios are based on the idea that this card, or I repeat, this surveillance system, had anything to do with tax or welfare fraud. Quite frankly, I don't think the people in charge really care how much people rip off or how many false bank accounts they want, as long as they can keep track of us. You see, once you've got all the banks, post offices and everything all networked into one network, Brian, every time you try and transact an account, they know where you are.
And what they don't want is for you to conduct all your transactions on a cash basis, because then there's no record.
Well,
or worse than that, on a barter basis.
I'd say about May next year, when they withdraw cash from Australian society, that won't be a problem for them.
You think they would withdraw it all? How do you mean withdraw it? They couldn't get away with that. People wouldn't wear that. A lot of people just don't trust cards. They don't have credit cards. They don't ask for credit. They want to do everything by cash. How would they get that through? That would provoke more antagonism than the ID suggestion.
Yeah, well, now we come to perhaps the most frightening aspect of everything, Brian. The work I have done, the research I've done, suggests that that is the game plan. That's what's going to happen. And as you've quite rightly pointed out, people won't wear it, which means that there must be some kind of force involved. The Australian Armed Forces, as we know, have been decimated physically, morally, financially. So one has to wonder where the peacekeeping force will come from to ensure that these things happen.
Some people feel that Australia is used as the guinea pig, that we're in at the cutting edge of some of this, as we are for the automatic teller machines. Now, is this the case with all of this, that we can't look at another country and say, oh, well, it's happened like that there, therefore it's going to happen to us? Is it the other way around? People overseas will look at us and they say, back in 88 it happened there, we can expect it next.
No, it's a combination of the two, Brian. Various ideas have been tried out overseas, just as separate, singular ideas. What has happened is once the ideas are perfected, they're put into place here in Australia. Australia is the first place in the world. We are the linchpin. We are the first place in the world that will get it all as a complete package by May next year.
If we can turn the clock back just a few years for those listeners who may not have heard of your background in recent years, when you first complained about loopholes when you were a Social Security investigator. You got no response or insufficient response, is that right?
Well, I went through 13 months of putting in star suggestions once a week, and they kept coming back saying the star suggestion doesn't accomplish anything because there wasn't the problem there that you perceive. A good example of this is in 1983, I put in a star suggestion on how to eliminate people in prison collecting dole payments, and they said that people in prison weren't collecting dole payments. Now, in 1986, they finally did an exercise and uncovered $1.25 billion worth of payments of dole to people in prison, or various benefits to people in prison. So, you see, you can't, and I wasn't the only person. I mean, it's, people in Social Security put in star suggestions all the time, and they're just ignored.
Are you the only one that stuck his neck out and thought you'd prove to them that there were loopholes by using the loopholes and then giving the money back?
I'm the only one who ever did it, Brian, and quite frankly, after 2 years, I've just about given up on waiting for the second person to come out and confirm confirm what I said.
What made you so angry that you'd take a risk like that?
Well,
or crazy, or I don't know if that's the right word, but...
Brian, on the one hand, people can walk into Social Security, and if they know what to say, they can get anything they want. The truth really is irrelevant. As long as you tell the right story which fits the right section of the manual of instructions, you can get virtually anything you want. Other people who are in desperate straits, but who don't know how to tell the right story, don't get anything. And people quite literally starve to death in the gutters in this country. Simply and purely because they don't know how to go about extracting or extorting things from the system.
And when you and your wife Marilyn, wasn't it, went across the country and got money illegally to demonstrate loopholes, what was it, $1,400 worth or something?
Yeah, it was only $1,400.
Uh-huh. And then you paid it back. You paid back a bit too much. But that's a minor point. What was the response of the authorities? They wanted to put you in jail for a long while, right?
Well, we became the only people ever to be prosecuted where there was no money to recover. It took 48 hours for the Department of Public Prosecutions to initiate action against us. For a comparison, I'd point out that the man who was in the paper last year who defrauded 300-odd thousand, it took 7 months before the actual charges were laid. The magistrate said that the Department of Social Security and the DPP had been very foolish. It was obvious what I'd been trying to demonstrate. He couldn't condone it, but he had enough cases go through his court every day to show that it was happening and action wasn't being taken about it. He dismissed the charges and didn't record a conviction.
Did you get costs?
No, we had to pay costs. $238.
That's not too much.
No.
That is a phenomenal escape from a potential 16 years.
It certainly was.
You were, I don't know about lucky, but I suppose lucky that whatever else is wrong with the country, we still have a court system which is an avenue of appeal, if you like, or the equivalent.
Well, the magistrate that we faced is known in West Australia as the Hanging Judge. So we were rather pleased with the result. Yeah.
So obviously you didn't make him angry.
No.
He didn't see you as a crook the way the public prosecutor had.
No, I actually asked for a copy of the book.
But it gives us all an insight into how angry Big Brother gets when you stamp on his toe.
I'm not the only case of that, Brian. There have been very many cases. There was a particular politician who bought in a colour telly and knocked back that he'd already got. Right back in WA where I came from, a fellow was actually using the Social Security office to sell marijuana. He was the assistant manager, and he used to do his deals through the office and store garbage bags full of marijuana in the safe in the Social Security office. Well, one of the other clerks there went on for 12 months. It was a joke. And one of the other clerks eventually dobbed the matter into the police, and they arrested the guy. Now, the fellow who'd been dealing in marijuana got sent to Fremantle Prison in Western Australia. He got a 4-year sentence, but after 10 months he was on day release. He never got sacked from Social Security. In fact, he then went on day release and worked in the finance department of Social Security and is now quite a big wheel in Social Security in WA.
Does that infringe any regulations?
No. You know, well, it doesn't.
Your record and your job in the public service are not
Well, apparently dope peddling isn't considered sufficient to throw you out of the public service.
What about the fellow who dobbed him in?
The fellow who dobbed him in got transferred to the remotest place in Australia with a social security office in it and just got left there to rot or resign. And after about 3 years, he resigned from the service.
Hmm. One doesn't realise just how organised crime can be, does one? But this stage we'll invite calls from listeners who might have a few questions about, well, you tell us your areas of expertise, Peter. Don't let me say it for you.
Oh, well, if people would like to know what... I won't say the government. It's a bit hard to call...
We won't narrow it down.
To call the people running the country the government, because the government's only a rubber stamp. But if people want to know what the bureaucracy and that is doing with their dollars, their tax dollars, and things like that, well, by all means, ring up.
Or if people have similar stories to tell. 269-0669 is the number. 269-0669. Back in a moment.
FII.
To do with pro-gun or anti-gun, it is a straight, simple disarmament of the population, as occurred in Czechoslovakia and other places. Mr. Pacello can say what he likes about decreases in murders and that, you know, guns don't murder people. That's the first thing people have to understand. Guns don't murder people. People murder people, and they use a gun if it's convenient. If there's not a gun, they'll use a screwdriver or a knife, or there's been cases of people putting insecticide in water, and there's been cases of people driving trucks through buildings. The psychopath is the problem, and psychopaths are caused in sick societies where everybody pays too many taxes and generally gets stomped on, and laws are made to divide the community between black and white and men and women and things like that. That's what causes psychopaths. Mr. Pacello should go away and start working on the problems, not the symptoms.
That is precisely my opinion, and you confirmed it exactly, Peter. Now, the problem is, as I see it, what is actually the purpose behind this people control which is being implemented? What are we being set up for?
Well, could I just say at this stage, while it might be a new kind of people control with the new technology here, a third of the world knows exactly what people control is like. It's so organized crime can maintain control of society, isn't that right?
Something like that, Brian. I had a little gentleman phone me up the other day who had been a lad in Czechoslovakia when that country was taken over. And he phoned me up and he was in tears. He'd read my newsletter. He said, yes, you're right. What is happening now is exactly what happened in Czechoslovakia. And I said to I used to say to my father, how did you possibly let it happen? And he said, we just used to say it couldn't possibly happen here. Now, he then struggled for decades to get his family out, finally got them out 7 years ago and escaped over the borders and brought his family to Australia, and now he's sitting there watching an exact rerun of what happened in Czechoslovakia. I have no doubts in my own mind why the population is being disarmed.
This is extremely interesting, I'm sure, to every concerned shooter, because the methods that are being employed are by no means commensurate with... As you say, these psychopaths, nobody can predict when they'll break out. And I always fail to understand it in that sense, but you certainly opened my eyes to a great many things. But again, I pose the question, cui bono, who stands to gain from this? Where are these people that are behind all these moves? Is it the Labour Party as such, or is it just the initiated in the Labour Party who are doing this? Or what is happening?
Well, there's a small group of people in the Labor Party, just as there are a small group of people in the Liberal Party and a small group of people in the National Party, whose alliances have nothing to do with the Australian people. Their alliances are with people overseas, and it is to their benefit that they are doing these things.
Because enormous power is the prize.
Well, of course, this is all about control, then.
Do you want people to fear you? Do you want people to love you, to like you, to respect you? If you miss out on some of those, you might settle for fear.
Which is a good and compelling reason to exact obedience.
If you're an unlovely person and people have picked on you all your life and you feel you can't get by playing it by the rules, then for some people the response is to have others fear them. That's the next best turn on.
So that's the bottom line.
To me it is, psychologically it is, yes.
I see. This is very clear. Thank you.
All right then.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in.
Again, repeating what I had told you, not only did it want
my tax file number, but it had not mentioned me as a widow at all. It only had said your de facto and partner, or your married partner, or your single income, and I was upset that they gave other people categories and not myself. And then, of course, they said, please fill in your tax file number, your partner's tax file number, your de facto tax file number, your age, etc., etc. So for the sake of my son, who I received that, which was at one stage an endowment, and I have endowed this country with four children, and...
Yes, but what is the question?
Well, no question. It was just a comment about how Mr. Sawyer had said connecting up with the birth...
You felt they were asking for more information than,
yes,
than they should
have.
Need.
I mean, in the past, they have never connected the tax number with the Social Security. Mm.
As if they were looking for every opportunity to put the right labels on.
Yes, they have. So I am just commenting on the fact that when I received the second form, it had the additional my birth, year of birth, etc., and I'm just not going to fill it in. They can keep their Social Security. Actually, they wouldn't care less. That's one advantage to them. But
I beg to differ. They would care. You see, the family allowance records, or what was previously known as child endowment records, have been kept for the last 20 years.
That's right.
So everybody who's under 40 in Australia, not only is their birth date, place of birth, mother and father and everything all on the family allowance files, the family allowance files were the first things that were dumped onto the computing system at Kent Street Deakin. That was the database file that they worked from, their initial filing system. Now, this exercise in getting everybody to send in their tax file number was just to save them the effort of matching up tax file numbers. Right. The people did it for them.
Right. Well, when you said under 40, now, I have four grown-up children, and my last child, I'm not under 40. And what did you mean by that? Did you mean that if you were under 40, they had all the information about the birth, or anybody who would have been receiving...
Well, off your family allowance record, they've got all the details of you. You're on the system.
Right.
And every child you've got that's under 40...
All right.
They also have the details of them from your file number.
Right. Yes.
Okay, then.
It's very neat. Yes, thank you very much.
Right, thank you for calling in. On 2GB, it's 11 and a half to 10. Let's take a break.
On radio.
I'd just like to say I'm an employee of the department, first of all, and I feel that the department's being painted in a rather poor light and quite unfairly, in my opinion. Now, if I can just sort of jump one step behind and comment on the previous lady's point. She was concerned that she had to give her date of birth on the form that she returned. Well, let's just say, for example, that lady's name was Mary Smith. Do you have any idea how many Mary Smiths would be in New South Wales and what chance the department would have of identifying the correct person without a date of birth on the form? Now, that's only, you know, for administrative purposes. That's an entirely reasonable thing to ask, in my opinion, and I'm sure that lady would be the first one to complain if they mixed up her with somebody else and cut off her payment or sent her payment to the wrong place. And so it's, you know, a perfectly understandable thing to require. And secondly, I'd like to question Mr. Sawyer's qualifications to be an expert on this area. Now, you referred to Mr. Sawyer as an investigator. Now, Mr. Sawyer was employed as a clerk to three with the department. Now, that the second to bottom grade clerk in the department, and he had very little experience there. He was only there for, I'm not sure the exact period, but something like 2 years. And I don't feel that he's qualified to speak on these things.
You're wrong about how long I was in the department and what level I was, but just before I tell or say what I was and where I worked,
right,
I'd be interested to know where you heard that I was a clerk 2-3 with 2 years' experience.
Well, somebody else in the department has told me that. But...
And you think people in the department would say nice things and the truth about me? You're that gullible.
No.
Listen, I spent If you work in Social Security, you're well aware that everything to do with the administration of benefits
right.
is done in regional offices.
That's
it's not done in Social Security headquarters or Canberra.
Right.
Right. Well, I worked as a clerk class 1 UB assessor, a clerk 2-3 UB continuations officer, a clerk class 4 family determining officer, a clerk class 5 USB determining officer, a clerk class 4 pensions examiner, a clerk class 5 pensions determining officer, and I filled in as the OIC pensions, and I trained as the OIC USB, and I did specific reporting work for benefits control in Perth, and I wrote one of the original reports for the Department of Social Security on the relevance or benefit of an ID card. Is that sufficient to qualify?
How many years were you at the department?
I first went into the public service in 1971. Then I went into national service, came back and worked for Social Security and the Commonwealth Employment Service for 4 years. I left the public service and I went back into the public service in 1982 into Social Security and was still there in 1985. Now, on top of all that, I have constant and continuous contact with over 300 public servants in the Department of Social Security, including a couple of assistant directors in Canberra,
right.
who pass on stuff to me because they're as fed up with your department as I am.
Yeah. I'm not saying the department's perfect by any means, but I just feel it's been rather unfairly treated.
Yeah, well, you see, I
facts wrong there. I apologise, but that's what I was told, and I was reasonably certain the person...
Yeah, how long have you been in the department?
I've been in the department 2.5 years.
You've been in the department 2.5 years. How much of Strat Plan have you got up and running?
Everything.
You can call up Darwin, you can call up Geraldton Regional Office, Western Australia, you can call up offices in Queensland, you can call up offices in Alice Springs instantly.
With the exception of Western Australia, everything.
There. You can get anybody on benefit anywhere in Australia.
That's right.
Okay. Do you know when the final implementation for Strat Plan in Western Australia was?
No, when was that?
19th of April, 1984. Do you know how much money they've spent since then?
I'm not denying for a minute that there's inefficiencies in the department.
No, there aren't inefficiencies.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. There aren't inefficiencies.
Yeah, Peter's theory is that there is a plan behind this, that people can't make that many mistakes. Is that right, Peter?
Well, the point is, Brian, that most of the equipment that was bought for Social Security is not being made available to Social Security. It's being used for other purposes.
Yeah, but some of these claims you're making are quite outrageous, like the move to abolish cash. It just would not be possible to abolish cash. There's always small transactions to be conducted that just can't be done through computers. It's just not feasible. You can't carry around little computers and, yeah.
You can carry a smart card, which can have all the details about your bank card. And make it so convenient.
If I owe you $1.
I'm sorry?
If I owe you $1, am I going to hand you a little card? You're going to pop it in the machine and...
I'm certainly, but...
As I put the finger on it, Brian, you will have $1. You have a coin for it, and next year you will have a $2 coin, and that is the cash you will have. Try conducting a cash economy with $1 and $2 coins.
But that's just a result of inflation. It's ludicrous to say anything else.
Well, it's not a matter of saying today or tomorrow, you know, the Treasurer says we'd take all the cash, you know, you can cash in your chips sort of thing. You wouldn't do that. People would be offered an incentive to go for the electronic alternative. But as you say, you'd always have a pocket full of money in case you wanted to buy some lollies or cigarettes or something.
That's just it. It can't happen. And, you know, these other claims about this telephone exchange being some big data centre, yeah, it's all totally like some... way up book, you know.
Well, it is. It's like we're living in somebody's novel. But could I just ask you, and I don't know, I haven't seen everything that Peter's seen, so I don't know if everything he says is 100%.
Right.
I simply find what he says interesting and food for thought. Go and work on this yourself. See if you can find out what the Kent Street Deacon structure is all about.
Well, actually, this man could do that for us, Brian, because if on Tuesday morning, if from his Social Security office he phones Central Headquarters in Canberra, asks them where their computer facilities are, he will find that on their directory, on the switchboard operator's directory, it is listed as at the National Computer Centre, Kent Street, Deakin. Now, officially, my friend, and I've been through all the budget portfolio programs for the last 10 years, there is no such thing as the National Computer Centre. But there it is in your department's own phone directory. And you can confirm that, and you can phone Brian up on Tuesday night and tell him whether I'm a liar or not.
Yeah, but it might just be a case of terminology, too. But just the National Computer Centre or something doesn't mean there's anything sinister about it.
Well, it wouldn't be. If the government had turned around and said, look, we're going to spend $1.5 billion building a National Computer Centre, mm. and we're going to put all the governments in and connect them all up in one big computing system, there'd be nothing sinister about it. The point is that the government has never admitted doing this.
The previous government.
Yep.
So you must admit it's food for thought, isn't it? We have to get to the bottom of it.
It would be interesting to find out more about that. It does sound a bit peculiar. But, you know, it still seems very far-fetched to me. I'd just like to make one more point. That was about Peter and his wife's charge that they're up on for defending the government, which, you know, obviously they did just for the purpose.
Hope you supplement your diet.
What's what? Who's who? What's happening? And where? You're about to get an inside view into the shape of things to come.
2GB News Talk 87 continues with Brian Wilshire.
I got to play that little piece at the start of the show tonight, but better late than never. And welcome back to the program. Peter Sawyer, special guest in the studio tonight. And we're inviting your comments and your questions about... it's hard to summarize all this. It's not a conventional conspiracy theory, which usually involves all sorts of bad guys overseas. And is pretty fascinating stuff. But we're looking particularly, I suppose, at the story behind the ID card. What was that designed to attract our attention away from? And the Parliament House in Canberra. Why is it as big and as expensive as it is? I have a sneaking suspicion it's more than just an Australian Parliament House. Peter, are there many people... in Canberra, concerned at the size and the cost of that, not simply cost because we're in debt and we can't afford buildings like that, but does it seem to be a bit of overkill for something as big, as imposing as that in a little place like Australia?
Well, as far as public servants go, no, Brian. I mean, public servants love to spend other people's money.
It's their empire.
Yeah, they'd love it to be twice as expensive. if they could have done away with the Italian marble and made it gold plate, I think they'd have gone for it.
Mm.
But there are many people in Australia who are concerned with the cost of Parliament House, and there's even some politicians down in Canberra who really think it was built for them, Brian.
Do you have any evidence that there's more underneath than meets the eye?
Well, I've heard a lot of stories about things underneath. What's more interesting is... the people from overseas who have quietly built 22 mansions around Canberra, which are sitting waiting vacant, currently just getting furniture put into them.
Are these fabulously wealthy bankers who can be lured away from the safety of the Swiss Alps? Or what?
Or
American politicians from the CFR?
Well, let's just say that the senior nephew of the Rockefeller Foundation is living in Canberra, overseeing the construction of these places.
That means Canberra must be a pretty safe place to live. That's not ground zero, is it?
Well, there's got to be a reason why Alan Bond, Robert Holmes the Court, Rupert Murdoch, and a lot of other people are buying down there.
That's where it's all happening.
Especially
when you can't buy land down there. You can only lease it, too.
Actually, I know.
There's no private ownership of... land as property down there.
There's a funny story, Brian. As you probably appreciate, a lot of stuff falls off the back of trucks out the front of my place.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's fallen off the back of a truck is a whole heap of... mind you, I haven't got it at my place anymore, if the federal police are listening.
Yeah.
Microfiche from the Department of Territories, who oversee this long-term leasing of the land. And it's surprising... how many senior public servants down that way, and we're talking people who earn $80,000 a year and that, how many of them, when this land comes up and gets advertised in things like the Darwin Gazette so that nobody else knows it's available,
yeah.
how they end up putting in the lowest tender and then claiming low-interest loans that are aimed at unemployed people at 5.5% and stating on their application forms that they're only earning $18,000, $22,000 a year, and even though they're known far and wide in Canberra, these things just aren't questioned. If there was anybody left in government that you could go to with these factors, I have tried the Commonwealth Ombudsman's office, but...
let's not mention the names anyway, but...
It'd be interesting to...
They all want more proof than you can find, is that it?
Oh, no.
The standard answer is, when you've got proof, bring it and we'll act immediately, if not sooner.
Yeah, I've been down that road, Brian. They say, give us your proof, and then the next time you ring them up, you find out your proof disappeared. So,
Your passport is safe with me. I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. Let's take another call on 269-0669. Good evening.
Hello, Brian.
Hello, thanks for waiting on.
Yes, I have one question for Peter Sawyer.
Yeah.
My question is that, having watched election minister for a long time, the public service stays the same while the governments change. And my question would be, would we get the linking of this information from different departments, regardless of which, whether the Liberals were in or the Labour Party was in?
You sort of hit the nail on the head. The continuation is through approximately 35 senior public servants. The work on the National Computer Centre, which doesn't exist, started under the Fraser government and has continued since then.
Right, so both major parties stand to gain by it.
Well, do they know what they're gaining? It's the bureaucracy that gains, isn't it?
Yeah, I think only
obviously the bureaucracy, yeah.
I've identified 38 people in the House of Representatives whom I think must have a fairly good idea of what's going on. They're spread across Liberal, Labor and National,
right.
And 11 people in the Senate. Now, the rest of them, the other 100-odd people down there, or nearly 200-odd people, they really haven't got a clue what's going on. I don't think any of them have even heard of the National Computer Centre,
mm-hmm.
Let alone the fact that they've approved $1.5 billion expenditure on it.
Right. So even if the Liberals had gotten in the last election, this would have still gone ahead.
Well, you know, there was that cartoon around of a steamroller steamrolling over people, and when you've got a steamroller steamrolling over the ordinary people of a country, it doesn't really matter who the driver is.
Right. Right, so what can the ordinary people do if both parties are sort of...
For a start, you've got to educate a few more politicians to tip the balance.
Right.
And presumably sufficient politicians on either side of the House... If alerted, you know, family people with a concern about the future of Australia and not a short-term interest in dancing on the world stage,
right.
They must be there. They started life as human beings. They can't be completely removed from the planet yet. What do you think, Peter?
Well, as I said, Brian, I've identified these 38. That means that there's 110 in there, and they're Liberal, Labor and National Party people. They're from all parties. Who obviously haven't been involved in this. Now, what I'd like to see for a start is that 110 insisting on a guided tour of this non-existent telephone exchange come National Computer Centre. I think if they got themselves in there, they might wake up to what's been going on.
Mm. Well, look, thank you very much. You've answered my question. I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Of course, some people might say, well, we've had computers for a long while. We've had dealings with departments with computers. So we're on computers. So what if we're on one computer? You know, we have a democracy. If we don't like the people, the way the people guide that computer or that steamroller, well, we put a bit different driver in. So why should we worry about this?
Well,
where's the evidence that this is going to be misused apart from the usual problems that you have with red tape?
Yeah, well, the problem is, Brian, that A, it's not supposed to exist.
So if they're hiding something, then we must be suspicious.
That's right. And B, it is already... This is the whole point. It's the point people miss about all this ID card business. It is already being used to monitor people. People all over Australia at the moment are being flooded with forms from the Bureau of Census and Statistics, and all that information is going into their database.
Now, they said they'd shred the information, didn't they? They just wanted the numbers. On that last one, was it 82?
86.
It was one before then.
Yeah, well, the first
big one that came out, I had bad feelings about that. I thought, why do they want to know so much? They can't need to know all this just to put pretty coloured graphs and maps on the wall.
Well, you see, the first one, Brian, was exactly as I was saying before. They do everything twice. The first one was just an effort in order to get you used to filling out this information and feeling happy about giving it in. The one in 1986 went straight into the National Computer Centre. All the information people supplied last year went straight in. It was actually processed in at the National Computer Centre.
Well, people say, so what if it's in Deakin? It might have been in Tasmania. I mean, the information was there. This is nothing new that the government has the information and they are going to use it for our good. Why should we worry?
Well, number one, the Bureau of Statistics keep telling us that our names are not attached to the information. It's all just used for general statistical purpose, and it's not.
And then destroyed.
Yeah, the paper gets shredded for sure. Until somebody shreds the Kent Street Deakin Centre, it's all still in there. Number two, I'm one of those people who are very wary when governments tell me they're doing things for my good.
Yeah, me too. For the benefit of the computer illiterates around, and I would probably be pretty close to that category, The microfish that fell off the truck, were they? Was that whale food on the way to the aquarium? Or the discs that computers put their...
No, these were the old records. See, all that's now on computer now, and it used to be on those microfish that you view under one of those microfish viewers that expands
all up. Like microfilm on a,
yes,
on a big rectangle.
Yes. Well, I think they were on the way to the tip, Brian, but...
They tipped a bit early.
They tipped a bit early, yeah, and sort of a few hundred miles away from where the Canberra tip is.
It's interesting, isn't it?
So if any of the politicians want to ring up and say it's all fantasy and nonsense, just check to make sure you or your or members of your family haven't bought land recently, because I'll know about it.
Now, even if most of what you said happened to be pretty wide of the mark, enough has happened over the past year or so to bring together millions of Australians who otherwise wouldn't have been brought together with a common concern. Is it too late?
No, Brian. The only thing that that we must guard against now is that that we're being conned again into believing we won, and everybody's throwing up their arms and saying the ID business is dead. For as long as the National Computer Centre exists, the issue is not dead. It's going on just according to plan.
And the connections with Brussels. But perhaps at this stage I should ask your opinion on something that was sent to me yesterday, as a matter of fact. An item from the Sydney Morning Herald of the 15th of February 1984, which ties in with something a caller said earlier in the week regarding SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. And it said here, among other things, in an article on the ethical questions posed by electronic banking, SWIFT links member banks throughout the world to meet international interbank processing and communications requirements. Since its foundation in 1973, SWIFT's membership has expanded rapidly. Today it envelops, that's in 1984, 1,104 banks, which are also competitors in 49 countries. According to The Banker magazine, SWIFT expects to have full worldwide membership within 5 years. And this was written 3.5 years ago. Now, our caller earlier in the week said that your Deakin, Kent Street Deakin computer facility was known as SWIFT, and he linked it with OTC. OTC has since denied that. What would you have to say about SWIFT? Is that just part of it? Is that one room in this building?
Well, there is one room in the building, Brian, which is leased, and I'm talking from local government and administrative services records. There is actually, before we get people again ringing up and saying, I don't know what I'm talking about, there is one area of the building. It's actually 1,500...